And as we move toward our message for today, we have this musical piece.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us, only sky. Imagine all the people living for today. Imagine there's no countries. Isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for. And no religion too. Imagine all the people living life in peace. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us. Imagine no possessions. I wonder if you can. No need for greed or hunger. A brotherhood of men. Imagine all the people sharing all the world. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us and the world.
Thank you, Rob, for that song. When I was in high school, which seems like a couple of lifetimes ago, one of my closest friends' name was Jerry. He had a last name that started with the letters ZYW. Well, as you might imagine, poor Jerry never was first in line for anything. In all of our classes, the teachers used seating charts according to the alphabet. And poor Jerry always ended up seated in one of the corners of the very last row. Just because. I share this with you this morning because our talk topic today is the last shall be first. Does that mean that my friend Jerry somehow became first in something? Well, we'll get into that a little bit later. First, we have to take a very detailed detour and talk about a very important prophet in the Hebrew Scriptures. And this would be the prophet Amos. Amos lived in the 8th century BCE. In Hebrew, his name, Amos, means burden bearer. Very appropriate for what he ended up doing. Before Amos, the major prophets, such as Elijah, delivered their messages orally. But Amos started a new trend. He put down his messages in writing. In this day and age, he may have been one of the first to use an iPad and post his words on social media. What I really want to emphasize about him is apparently his life was incredibly ordinary. He wasn't a government official or a member of the military. He wasn't royalty. He was a shepherd. And in his own words, Amos states, "I am a herdsman and a dresser of sycamore trees." He was not religiously trained to become a priest, or certainly not a high priest. Financially, we don't know. He may have been doing okay before becoming a prophet, but in his own words, "The Lord took me from following the flock, and the Lord said to me, 'Go prophesy to my people Israel.'" And so Amos said, "Bye-bye, black sheep and white sheep," and off he went. Now, you may find that what I have shared so far about Amos is to be mildly interesting. You may find it actually to be boring. I mean, after all, we're talking about something that took place 2,800 to 29 years ago. What does this have to do with you or me or us? And I shared a bit of his background with you to make a point. Being called by God or Spirit has nothing to do with prominence or your standing in social order. It has nothing to do with your financial portfolio, your bank account. It has nothing to do with holding a political office. Historically, throughout the scriptures, Spirit has worked with the likes of a shepherd boy like David to slay Goliath. Moses was an orphan. Jesus called forth fishermen and tradesmen. And he himself was known as the son of a carpenter. I raise this because how many times in our lives have we thought, "It wasn't my place to say or to do something," or "It wasn't mine to step in. I wasn't about to say anything. Who am I to interfere?" Have you ever looked at something and thought, "Gee, oh my God, that's terrible. That's a shame. What am I supposed to do? It's not my problem." Eldridge Cleaver, an early leader of the Black Panthers, said, "If you're not part of the solution, you must be part of the problem." And that's a little bit of a misquote, but it is the gist of his message. In our way shower, Jesus said, "If you are not with me, you are against me." And it's easy to move then in that direction of, "I'm with you, Lord. What am I supposed to do?" And then there is perhaps the most classic rationale of all. "I'm just minding my own business," or "it's really none of my business." This frequently is preached in Unity all of the time. There once appeared an article in Unity magazine several years ago suggesting that we adopt "mind your own business" as our sixth Unity principle. And I in no way mean to denigrate the author of that article, because I understand the concept that she was promoting. Basically, it's saying, work on yourself and don't focus on fixing others or the world. I get it, but I do disagree. One of the more effective ways we can work on ourselves is to be present to one another. And on the flip side, one of the more devastating and harmful personal experiences comes in the knowing that something isn't right, isn't what it's supposed to be. Knowing that someone is really hurting or being hurt, and then responding by saying, it's none of my business. When millions of Jews were being exterminated during the Holocaust, there were thousands of other casualties. Those who were aware but said or did nothing. And I really believe that with each death, a little bit of their humanity died too. The story of Amos is a classic example. He could not, would not, go on minding his own business. During his time, there actually were two Jewish kingdoms. There was the kingdom of Judah in the south and Israel in the north. Amos lived in Judah, but he felt that he was called to deliver a message to the northern kingdom. And let me tell you, he wasn't exactly greeted with open arms. The ruler of Israel, Jeroboam II, told him to go home and mind his own business. And he got into it with the chief priest, Amaziah, who actually brought charges of treason against him. So yes, no question, sticking your nose into somebody else's business can be painful, dangerous. But looking or turning away from what you are called can be much worse. A couple of weeks ago, Susan was bitten by our own dog, Rocky. Why? A dog fight broke out between our dog and a visiting Great Dane. Susan stepped in to separate them and was bitten. You know, and it's funny, when I share that story with people, they all understood. What could Susan do? She had no choice. She had to step in. I mean, couldn't just let the dogs tear each other apart. It was pretty obvious, right? Is it a less obvious situation to somebody who witnesses an elderly lady getting beaten and mugged but chooses to stay out of it? Is it less obvious to someone who hears the screams of a young girl being beaten and raped in the street and responds by pulling down their window shades because they don't want to be involved? There are countless stories in the Hebrew scriptures of God punishing his people because of their infidelity, for their sin of turning away from God and worshiping golden calves or some other false idols. And part of Amos's message addressed this. It was part of his prophetic mission. But Amos had an even more significant agenda: humankind. When Amos showed up in Israel, life was really pretty beautiful. Everything was peaches and cream, at least, well, as far as the government and religious powers were concerned. There was a large part of the population that was doing quite well, thank you. And for them, life couldn't be better. Israel was in an era of good feeling, riding high in military expansion and a booming religious movement. Does this ring any bells for anyone? I don't know. I think it sounds a lot like post-World War II in America. A time when everything was great for the haves. For the have-nots, not so much. This was the major part of Amos's message. He openly attacked and criticized social injustices. Poor people were being taxed beyond what they had. Human trafficking was going on, and people were suffering. The poor were in a lot of trouble. And it's important to understand that all of this human suffering was not in addition to the Israelites turning their backs on their God who brought them out of slavery, but rather it was directly related to them losing sight of their God, the one power, the one source who truly was active in their lives and rescued them. Sometimes we do some crazy thinking. when things are sailing along and going great, it's so easy not to be mindful, to lose sight of our relationship with Spirit. And when things go horribly wrong, it's so easy to ask, Lord, why? What did I do to deserve this? And even, how could you do this to me? I mentioned before that it wasn't clear whether Amos was an illiterate sheep herder or a man of some wealth. My guess is that he probably was a man of means because of his writing skills. It really doesn't matter, though. The point is whether he was wealthy or just making ends meet. He shelved it. He left it all behind. He left who he was, his job, probably his family, and he responded to that still small voice in his heart. I think that most of us at times, and probably all of us at one time or another, participate in what I would call onion theology. And that is, our priorities are layered. And we allow ourselves to go, or what layers we allow to be peeled back are guarded and restricted. And so I have to ask, what layer is our Christ essence? Is it somewhere near the surface where it can be easily accessed? Is it really buried, remaining at our core, where so many layers, layer after layer, have to fall away before we can manifest it? When we go into the silence to listen to that still small voice, as we will be doing very shortly this morning, we talk about leaving our troubles and worries at the door. Yet, might we still be smuggling in any of our filters? Are there things we withhold, refuse to put on the table? Are we clinging to anything that demands our attention, our commitment, ahead of what Spirit is calling us to be and to do? Is there a job that's more important? Is there a relationship that's more important? And it may sound silly, but is there a sports team that's more important? Perhaps a habit or an addiction? Is there any part of us that is selective in terms of what we will hear when in the silence? Jesus said, "Seek ye first the kingdom." Imagine the spiritual shudder that Amos must have experienced when he heard or felt the call. How difficult must it have been for him to walk away from his livelihood and from his very life? Can we even imagine letting go of everything to travel someplace? Not just geographically, but emotionally, psychologically, where you know you will not be welcomed to deliver a message that almost definitely is going to end up being rejected? There's a point here that I cannot prove, but I really think it's true. Amos is one of the books of the Hebrew Scriptures. It tells his story and what he did. And I believe that what singles him out and makes his story unique and powerful is not that he was called, but rather that he answered that call. Because I believe that God or Spirit constantly calls out to all of creation. I believe others at that time of Amos probably got a very similar call. We read about Amos because he responded. Our way shower said, "Many are called, but few are chosen." When we are called, we become chosen first. When we allow ourselves to bring that call into our consciousness. when we allow the call, not just to fill our heads, but our hearts. And then the second part of that is when we reply, yes. Yes. Here I am, Lord. Are we not being called today? Surely all of us are aware that there are places and situations where people are really hurting, where people are hungry, where human trafficking is going on just as it was in the kingdom of Israel 2,800 years ago? Are we patiently just biding our time until some modern day Amos at long last hears the message and responds? Or is there something, anything, that we can do to answer a call that is so blatantly obvious? There's no doubt we live in a truly challenging time, but it's not so unique. It's not anything that hasn't happened before. We live in such a polarized nation right now. Really close, lifelong friends have severed relationships over politics. A couple of weeks ago, I forced myself to call my sister, who is so far away from where I am on the political spectrum. And I didn't dance around that. I openly acknowledged it. And I just said to her, it doesn't matter. I just want to let you know that I love you and that I care about you. And she said, Michael, that's wonderful. I love you too. Now, I guarantee, I assure you, that making that phone call to my sister will not get me my own book in the Bible. The only reason that I shared that story with you is to say, it's okay to start small. But just start. I do not expect any of you to leave your jobs or family and stand on a soapbox preaching the gospel in a foreign city. I don't expect any of you to travel north, cross the border into Canada, and preach social injustice to the Canadians. My simple call to you this morning is to really try to feel that which you are already being called to, and then make a decision. Check out the layers of your own onion theology and mindfully, deliberately prioritize them. I believe I shared with you just a few weeks ago how when I was a congregant at Unity Northwest, one of the true leaders of that church, of that community, left us to join a congregation on Chicago's west side because he felt he was needed there. Until today, he remains the only white member of that church. But he heard something, and he couldn't ignore it, and he answered it. This morning, I opened with the story of my classmate, Jerry, and I promised I would say more. The week of graduation, a couple of the seniors went to the dean and suggested that at the commencement exercise, the graduates' names should be called out in reverse order. They thought it would make for a nice gesture to accommodate those who for 4 years were the tail on the dog. The dean said he would discuss it with the faculty. Well, Jerry found out about this request, and he went to the dean and asked him, don't do this, it's not necessary. He said, where we rank alphabetically means absolutely nothing. Where we go from here is all that matters. And at the graduation ceremony, he was given a special award for school spirit, acknowledging the awareness that he had shared. But I do have to tell you, it was kind of amusing because It ended up being the last award that was given out that day. Amos's primary focus was on the poor, the downtrodden. On the hierarchy of which people counted the most, these were the people who were at the bottom, the people who were last. In unity, we boldly claim that each of us at our core, at our essence, is the Christ. The very nature of this awareness means that there cannot be even one single exception, or it all breaks down. It's a powerful consciousness that bonds us together. And more than that, it dissolves any sense of separateness from God. It solidifies our communion with Spirit. And in that communion, words like first or last become meaningless, because in that reality, all of us become elevated. And things like money or power or good looks or possessions ultimately are peeled away until all that remains are our hearts and the reality, the truth, the beauty of the Christ within. It quickens the Amos consciousness within. At the end of his prophecy, Amos was optimistic because he was aware that in this covenant between God and Spirit and us was an ongoing eternal commitment on the part of God. And yeah, sometimes that covenant, that contract, has to be called into question. Just as a contract in real life, when one of the parties falls short of doing what he or she is supposed to do to execute the contract. The beauty of Amos's prophecy was that it would come together, precisely because of that incredible love that God holds for his people. And so it really is the case. The last become first, and all is well. And so let's take this to prayer and to meditation.